From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and it's been a pretty remarkable day. Today, President Trump abruptly ended his scheduled meeting on infrastructure with Democratic leaders Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi to come outside the White House and rail at Democrats after Nancy Pelosi said earlier this morning that Democrats think he's undertaking a cover-up.
And I told Senator Schumer, Speaker Pelosi, I want to do infrastructure. I want to do it more than you want to do it. I'd be really good at that. That's what I do. But you know what? You can't do it under these circumstances. So get these phony investigations over with.
Let's bring in NPR congressional reporter Kelsey Snow. Hi, Kelsey.
Hi there.
Kelsey Snell, rather. I just gave you the name Snow. Look, it's just because it's just been kind of unsettling. The president was furious. He went on for quite a while. But some might say, can you blame him? We thought these were odd optics going into today. The infrastructure meeting coming right after the meeting Democrats had to talk about impeachment. Let's hear what Pelosi said earlier after that meeting with House Democrats.
It was a very positive meeting, a respectful sharing of ideas, and I think a very impressive presentation by our chairs. We believe that no one is above the law, including the President of the United States, and we believe that the President of the United States is engaged in a cover-up.
So, Kelsey, I mean, thoughts. Of course, the president hearing that is probably not going to be feeling like walking into a meeting.
Well, there were already signs that this meeting was going to be difficult. The president has said ever since the State of the Union that it's either impeachment or investigation or legislation. And there were signs already going into this that, you know, that there would be tension here. Now, Democrats basically said that they didn't have much of a choice but to have this meeting when they had it. They had a very tense meeting yesterday in which many, many members started to want to have a conversation about how they were going to proceed with forcing the administration to comply with a whole host of subpoenas and other document requests that so far the White House has been completely unwilling to engage with. Now, with that in mind, Pelosi scheduled this meeting to give her members a chance to talk, but the timing really was, as you mentioned, very difficult because they were going to try to go into this infrastructure conversation. Though it was a very brief meeting at this point, as far as we know, and Democrats are already raising questions about what the president's intent was when he scheduled this.
Right. He scheduled it, he said he scheduled it a while ago. But again, just the optics were very odd. And just remind us that impeachment meeting, some Democrats adamant about starting an impeachment inquiry. We're actually hearing the word inquiry more because that's investigating whether to impeach, which is to charge the president. A trial would be held in the Senate if the president was actually impeached or charged. Why are some congressmen calling for an impeachment inquiry?
Well, one of the theories that is working among many Democrats is that starting the impeachment process would give them more tools to force, essentially, the administration to comply with their requests on documents and subpoenas. Now, I will say that there are other Democrats included who say that they're not entirely certain that that is true, that they would actually get these additional powers. And I think a lot of it is Democrats are looking for the right path forward to get what they want at the end of the day, which is responses from this White House on everything from the president's taxes and business dealings to involvement in all of the details of the Mueller investigation and Russian interference in the 2016 election. So they are asking a lot of questions about President Trump, his personal business dealings, and this administration. And there are some people in the Democratic Party who think that an impeachment inquiry would make that process easier.
Now, look, we're going to take this up over the course of the day on NPR because it just was so jolting, the whole day. But back to Nancy Pelosi's comments when she came out from that meeting. She didn't mention impeachment. She did say, by the way, that the Justice Department agreed to share some intelligence with Congress, which at the time there was some thought that that might de-escalate some of these tensions. Then, of course, everything flared up when she made that comment about the president being engaged in a cover-up. What's your sense of what she was doing there?
Well, I will say, talking to members as they came out of that meeting, the tension did appear to be de-escalating. This is something that Pelosi is quite skilled at, which is having meetings and allowing Democrats to kind of exchange ideas and to vent a little bit. And then it also gives them a chance to decide whether or not everybody's on the same page, to demonstrate to one another where the actual majority of their caucus is. And people coming out of that meeting said there is a vocal minority of people who want to go down the impeachment route. And the majority are still interested in investigations and in kind of taking a slower, more deliberate approach that is more traditional to the investigative process. When Pelosi made the cover-up comment, it does kind of move things forward, and it poses the question, how does she make a comment like that and then move forward, you know, right, on investigations?
Well, and now it seems as if the battle is going to be who actually didn't get infrastructure done, because we heard Chuck Schumer come out of what was supposed to be that meeting and say, your jaw would have dropped if you saw the president walk out of this meeting. But on the other hand, the president can say, how can I work with them when they think I, you know, say I'm having a cover-up?
Yeah, that is one of the great battles of 2020 to come, of the 2020 election process. And this is something we expected. There will be a lot of blame going around, right, about who was to blame for not getting things done.
NPR congressional reporter Kelsey Snell, thank you.
Thank you.
We've brought you a number of stories recently about the legal use of recreational marijuana, which is now allowed in 10 states and the District of Columbia. But it's still illegal for members of the military to use the drug for any reason. Colorado Public Radio's Dan Boyce tells us about the tension that creates in places like Colorado, where recreational pot is fair game for almost everybody else.
On a recent tour of a rec center at Fort Carson Army Base, I see a tall, door-framed size poster headlined, "The Costs of Marijuana." Through charts and graphics, it lists the Army's perspective on pot's physical costs, social costs, usage trends.
It emphasizes the fact that marijuana still continues to be the drug of choice in all of our services.
That's Donna Klaus. She's the Prevention Services Branch Chief for the Army's Substance Abuse Program. She's based at Fort Sam Houston in San Antonio, Texas. Her group created the poster, which is posted at bases around the country. Another part of the poster shows a color-coded map of the U.S., split up by whether marijuana is legal recreationally or medically.
We understand that there might be confusion, especially for individuals who live in the states where marijuana use is legal.
For the military, there's no confusion. It is never okay for soldiers to use, even if they're stationed in a legal marijuana state. At a recent Colorado Springs City Council candidate debate.
All right, candidates, do you support the sale of recreational marijuana in Colorado Springs?
The Springs, where Fort Carson is located, is the largest city in Colorado that has not legalized recreational marijuana stores. Many here complain the city is likely missing out on millions in revenue from highly taxed pot shops. But so far, local officials just aren't willing to risk angering the armed forces. There are 5 bases in the Colorado Springs area, and they form a cornerstone of the local economy. Here's newly elected council member Wayne Williams.
Folks, the last thing we need to do is to make recreational marijuana yet another reason why the Defense Department opts to take missions, troops, personnel, and move it somewhere else.
Somewhere else, like maybe the Army's Redstone Arsenal in Huntsville, Alabama.
Which I've been told likes to badmouth Colorado Springs from time to time because of cannabis.
Andrew Heaton runs a medical marijuana business in Colorado Springs, which are legal. He says having legal marijuana near a base does not mean more soldiers will use the drug. He says in cities like Huntsville, you can still go off base and buy pot on the street.
In a community where it's legal, you've got it off the streets for the most part.
Now, there are many who would debate that point, but aside from that, Heaton also points out military members undergo random drug tests. And if you come up positive, it doesn't matter where the pot came from.
And none of them want to get what they call the BCD, the big chicken dinner, which is a bad conduct discharge.
Not surprisingly, active duty soldiers are wary of talking about any marijuana use. But as legalization has spread, some veterans are getting increasingly vocal, saying it's time to re-examine the policy. Matthew Kale served in the Army in Afghanistan.
Had 2 deployments and 1 medevac.
His face was badly injured, traumatic brain injury, spinal injuries, PTSD. It left him taking a lot of medication.
Yeah, it was a whole laundry list. It was opiates, benzodiazepines.
20 or so different things. But he moved to Colorado to try marijuana as an alternative and says it largely worked. He started reducing his pills, medication by medication.
And eventually I got it down to nothing.
He now runs an organization focused in part on securing the right for veterans to use medical cannabis. And he thinks it's time to be realistic about active duty soldiers and drug use, too.
I know of people who are deployed, and they often come across hash in Afghanistan. They use hash in order to medicate not just the horrors, the hardships of war, but to alleviate the boredom.
Donna Klaus with the Army's Substance Abuse Program says this is all beside the point. As long as marijuana remains illegal federally, the rule stands.
Illegal drug use and abuse remains incompatible with both military and civilian services in the Army.
Last year, the Department of Defense released a memo specifically reaffirming its prohibition on marijuana, medical or otherwise. For Here and Now, I'm Dan Boyce in Colorado Springs.
In Living Color, the barrier-smashing sketch show from the 90s, a mostly black cast, black writers, writing for black America. Anyone else want to join in? Fine. Creator Keenan Ivory Wayans tapped the best in talent. Chris Rock played that cheapskate who wouldn't pay more than $1.25 for anything.
How much for a new paper?
35 cents.
35 cents? Good Lord! That's a lot of money. How about I give you 10 cents and you give me the good news?
The good news is when you leave.
And the white guy was played by Jim Carrey, who played Fire Marshal Bill.
Don't touch that dial, Mary Tyler Moore. It's a zombie! Not quite, son, but I do appreciate the Haitian culture. I'm Fire Marshal Bill Burns, and nobody likes a quitter. Scalpel!
Keenan Ivory Wayans was a student of television. He wanted a dance group like Jackie Gleason's June Taylor dancers. He called his the Fly Girls. They inspired generations of young women. Here are some lining up for a 2012 reboot.
So we're here at the Fly Girl auditions for In Living Color. It's coming back.
Fly Girls were the best of. They were the best dancers, the most technical, the most fun to watch, the best looking. They took care of themselves. They were the whole package.
Fly Girl is for sure an icon. It's like something that little girls can look up to. Like,
yeah,
I want to
models.
Be them. I used to look up to the Fly Girls like one day. So even to be here is like
a big deal.
Thank you. I always wanted to be a Fly Girl.
The Fly Girls were choreographed and really created by Rosie Perez, who went on to be, well, Rosie Perez, the Emmy and Oscar-nominated actress. In Living Color was based in L.A. She was from New York, Puerto Rican, with the now famous accent. She'd shuttle home to troll hip-hop clubs for the latest moves. The girls' outfits were considered high hip-hop fashion. Recently, Rosie, along with some of the show's cast members, reunited at the 18th annual Tribeca Film Festival to celebrate the show's 25th anniversary. We thought we'd ask her about it as well. Rosie Perez, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And take us back. You know, for people who might not have been there 25 years ago, how much fun was this show and how much of an opportunity was it for someone of color?
The show was really, really fun. And for people of color, it was an amazing opportunity. You would walk into the office and there were people of color there. So
the idea of doing something that was kind of a black SNL had been floating around for a while. You had danced in clubs. You caught the eye of Don Cornelius in Soul Train, but he didn't seem to get you.
Yeah, I had asked him way back when. I said, would you be my manager? And Don Cornelius' response was, in order to manage someone, they have to have something to be managed. And I said, excuse me? He goes, besides of you just shaking your I mean, what is it?
Ooh.
And yeah. And I got up and I walked out of his office. And it was years later, I was choreographing an event for AIDS. And Mr. Cornelius was there. And he says, I owe you an apology. I was wrong.
You had real skills. Where did you get your dance chops?
Well, I was a ward of the state for a while when I was younger, and the nuns taught me how to tap dance and modern dance.
This was at a Catholic children's home in New York.
Yes, and it was run by nuns and priests. That was the beginning of it. And then in school, I was the manager of the cheerleading team. I would say those two elements were what led me to become a choreographer.
A lot of do-it-yourself stuff back then. We talked about Don Cornelius. Then you go to Los Angeles. You're out dancing at a club. Spike Lee is there. He was having a butt contest to see which black chick had the biggest, I'll say, butt to promote School Days, which disgusted you, but what? You decided to do what?
I jumped on the stage and climbed up on the speaker and started making a mockery out of it all. I was like, is this what you want? And I was bending over, and he brought over a security guard, and I thought they had brought him over to throw me out. And he says, we just don't want you to get hurt. Get down. So I got down, and he goes, tonight is fate. And I said, oh, you wish. And I had no idea in his head he was considering me for Do the Right Thing.
You know, you think you're slick, Tina.
I don't know. How else was I going to get you up here? I haven't seen you for a week.
I'm working, you know, making money, getting paid.
I see you forgot the ice cream again. You know, your memory's getting really ridiculous. It's disgusting.
I just forgot. You know, I got a lot of things in my mind.
Yeah, and I really wanted some ice cream, too.
Look, you're making...
That was Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing. Then you're hired for In Living Color. You held a nationwide search for dancers. It attracts hundreds of them. And here's a clip showing an audition that you held for the show.
When I call your name, step over to the side. That means you have been picked. Everybody else, give yourself a round of applause. It was a great audition. This is not the one. We're just narrowing it down even further, okay? Okay, so girl at the blue top, checkered pants, Jennifer.
Okay, so that Jennifer is J-Lo, who became a member of the Fly Girls in season 3. So talk about Fly Girls.
Initially, Keenan Ivory Wayans had offered me the job, and I was very excited about it. And when I walked in, the prejudice kicked in right away. As soon as I opened the door, it's like, okay, she's New York, she's Puerto Rican. You know, they had all these preconceived notions of who I was and,
that's
and my
interesting.
Abilities.
That's interesting because, you know, almost exclusively black cast, writers, staff, everything. You were of color, but brown.
Yeah.
Yeah. Huh.
Yeah. And I had an assistant who had been working with me forever. His name is Arthur Rayner, and he's black. He just looked at me and he said, forget these girls. Come on, let's do our thing. And thank goodness he said that because he knew the real me. I was shaking inside. Mm. And I said, okay, line up. And, you know, and that's how it went.
I'm back, a black queen, upon the scene with a knack for funky tracks. Know what I mean? Prince Paul produces this, and it's a fly one. It had to be that way. He's one of my sons.
It went beyond the choreography. You chose and edited the music, helped craft the whole image. The show won Primetime Emmy Awards for Outstanding Variety Music and Comedy Series. It won People's Choice Awards for Favorite New Comedy Series. It had characters like Homie the Clown, the verbally abusive clown doing gigs for low pay as part of his prison release program, played by Damon Wayans. Let's listen.
Hi, children. My name is Homie D. Clown.
Yeah!
Oh, isn't that sweet? Look, children, an apple for the teacher. Mm-hmm. In other words, you're trying to win my affection and become the teacher's pet, ain't you?
Okay, well, it was pretty funny at the time. But when you listen to this, you know there were questions about what is happening here. They were not doing the show for a white audience. But a lot of people questioned, you know, was it too ethnic? Was it stereotypical? What were they doing? Were you part of any of those conversations about what the show was supposed to do?
We already all knew what the show was supposed to do. And coming from New York, you know, for me, In Living Color reminded me of The Colored Museum by George C. Wolfe. The Colored Museum was a series of skits that were performed on Broadway as a part of a collective, like a whole play. It was being unapologetic and discussing issues in the African-American community from an African-American's perspective. Mm-hmm. When I was pitched what In Living Color was all about, I was very, very excited.
Well, you can find clips of The Colored Museum on YouTube, and on your recommendation, we have one. This is Miss Pat, a black stewardess in a bright pink uniform on a ship departing from the Gold Coast. Let's listen.
Hi.
I'm Miss Pat, and I'll be serving you here in cabin A. Now, we'll be flying at an altitude that's pretty high, so shackles must be worn at all times.
Oh, you can see the line from that to In Living Color. Here's another clip. Damon Wayans and David Greer starring as the gay movie critics.
Welcome to Men on Films. Tonight, we have a brand new sponsor, Ballpark Franks. They plump when you heat them.
That they do.
Okay. It goes on. Rosie, how would you place In Living Color in television history?
Oh, I would say that it's in the at least the top 50 or maybe even top 25 of influential, game-changing television shows in American history, you know, because it dared to be what it wanted to be. And it was so collaborative as well. Like you just played that clip about the gay movie critics. Damon Wayans and David Alan Greer would come to me and say, okay, give us the lingo of, you know, the gay culture, since you're back and forth to New York. And like I said, well, you could say, oh, you got red. And they go, what does that mean? And, you know, so I said, you should like snap in the air. And they go,
wait, what does that
mean?
What does that mean, you got red?
When somebody reads you, they kind of tell you off and they just insult you in the most clever way. You got red.
Mm. So collaborative. And also they recognized a New York Puerto Rican choreographer. They recognized you.
Yeah, well, that was Keenan. You know, it was fantastic. I just had dinner with Jim Carrey and we just started crying at dinner. I was like, oh my gosh, it's been years. You know, everybody was just, it was a family and it was really, really fantastic.
That's actress Rosie Perez, the Fly Girls choreographer on In Living Color, talking about what would be the 25th anniversary of that terrific, groundbreaking show. Rosie, thank you so much.
Thank you. And I'm so happy that you're doing this because it's well deserved.
Here and Now and the following message is supported by Daily Harvest. Daily Harvest delivers carefully sourced, chef-crafted smoothies, soups, harvest bowls, overnight oats, and more, all built on fruits and vegetables. Each single-serving cup can be prepared in minutes. Daily Harvest is designed for convenience, so you can load up on fruits and vegetables first thing in the morning, before bed, and anytime in between. Learn more about Daily Harvest and get 3 free cups in your first box at dailyharvest.com/now.
Nashville's public schools are adding Kurdish to a list of languages available for high school credit. The city has more Kurds than any other in the United States, and supporters say adding the language will help them meet the needs of an increasingly diverse student population. Shalina Shatlani from WPLN in Nashville reports.
Friday service at the Salahuddin Community Center in South Nashville has just ended. Its director, Nawzad Harami, is eagerly shaking hands with patrons. The Salahuddin Center was established 2 decades ago to serve a growing population of Kurdish refugees relocating to Nashville. The shared language here is Kurdish, and Harami says many community members have been looking for ways to preserve their language. So, last summer, he asked the local Nashville school board member if Kurdish could be taught in public schools.
It's different, you know. Learning at home and learning, you know, at school is different, you know. Learning at school is the formal way, learning at home, you know, just random way, you know.
Over 1,100 students from the Kurdish community attend Nashville public schools. Many, like 11th grader Alan Koshna, say the formal curriculum will help them stay connected to their heritage. And, Koshna says, it could help him form relationships with other students.
In my grade, I feel welcomed. I don't hate anyone there, and I don't think they hate me. But having just another connection to make it a bigger community is what I want.
Public school systems like Nashville's are getting more diverse. In fact, federal data show that American public schools are majority students of color. Hallie Potter, a policy expert for a national education research group, says schools are adapting to attract these diverse families who have more school choice options than ever before. Offering a range of foreign language options is One strategy, among others, like
looking critically at what texts are being taught in language arts classes, how the social studies curriculum is reflecting backgrounds and histories of students who are coming into the classroom, and then even thinking about what diversity of a teaching force looks like.
If public schools don't address changes to their students' demographics, Potter says, families may choose not to send their kids there. And student enrollment determines how states get federal funding for public education. Schools could also risk sending a message that they don't care what families want. That's why Nashville School Board approved the language request in January. Members felt it would serve a community need. And it can also improve Kurdish students' academic performance, says Jill Petty, who manages literacy and world languages for Nashville's public schools.
Research has shown that when a student is literate in his or her own native language, it helps them become literate in a new language faster, such as English. So that would actually help them in the long run.
Petty acknowledged there could be some pushback, but she says she thinks most families will be receptive.
There is support for their plight, and not only just humanitarian, but that need to support people who are looking for a better opportunity.
A better opportunity is exactly how some public school parents in the Kurdish community see this request, like Ahmad Mosa. He says many Kurds have been historically persecuted for speaking their language.
The United States is different. It's freedom. I will be happy to see Kurdish language in our metro schools.
For Here and Now, I'm Shalina Chatlani in Nashville.
We've been talking with presidential hopefuls ahead of the 2020 election, and today we're sitting down with candidate Tim Ryan. He's a Democrat who represents Ohio's 13th congressional district. Congressman, welcome.
Great to be with you.
Well, as you know, a number of states have passed restrictive abortion laws in recent weeks. In your home state, Ohio's new law bans abortion around 6 weeks, and there's no exception for rape or incest. What can Democrats do to protect Roe v. Wade?
Well, this is abhorrent. I mean, many women don't even know they're pregnant until after 6 weeks. So this is a draconian law. We, from the federal level, I mean, we've got to continue to try to fund programs around prevention, around Planned Parenthood, making sure that women in these states still have some access to contraception. So that's going to be really important. But we got to start winning elections. I mean, we got to start winning races. And I think we turn the tide on this particular issue with what's happening now. A lot of women very courageously telling their stories about why they had an abortion and what it was like, and humanizing this. And that starts to shift the public narrative on it.
You once considered yourself pro-life. What made you change your mind?
I changed my mind when I started meeting women who explained to me exactly what they were going through. And really, I began to understand how complicated and complex pregnancies are, and that the government has no business being between the doctor and a woman.
Hey, you are Catholic, correct?
I am.
Do your beliefs today conflict with your faith?
I believe my faith supports my position, because to me, being Catholic, to me, being Christian, to me, following the teachings of Jesus is about being compassionate and open-hearted toward people who, you shouldn't be judging. And to me, I don't understand all of the different scenarios that women are under. And nobody does, and so you show compassion.
In an op-ed that you wrote in 2015 explaining your position and your change of heart, you said that you believe there are people of good conscience on both sides of the abortion argument. Do you think that's still true today with this wave of new restrictive state laws that we've been seeing?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think you want to have a blanket view of everybody on every issue. Clearly, the people pushing these laws are political in nature. They're very narrow-minded. But I do feel there's a lot of people in the gray area that have maybe never met anyone that's had an abortion. That they this isn't something they maybe necessarily think about a lot. But I think once they hear these stories, they may be persuaded to have a different view, and you don't want to close that down, just like Planned Parenthood and Cecile Richards and the leaders at NARAL when I came into Congress as a pro-life Democrat. They didn't cut me off. They didn't ignore me. They engaged me, and it you know, led to me opening my heart and mind to the other side of this issue.
Okay, let's move on to trade. Like the president, you have been critical of U.S. trade policy over the years. Do you think President Trump is right to be tough on China?
Well, being tough on China is one thing. Being completely erratic with no strategy and dragging businesses and farmers through the mud, using them as pawns in the game, is not the way to beat China. I mean, tariffs are meant to be very targeted for particular reasons, like when China dumps steel on our country and puts, you know, people out of work. You have a targeted approach through the World Trade Organization, through the International Trade Commission, to remedy that situation.
What so you disagree with this tit for tat the president is in with China on the tariffs?
Yeah, well, it's destabilizing. It's, I mean, you know, he's killing the farmers. I mean, I was out in Iowa just this weekend, and they are getting annihilated. The manufacturing around agriculture, the community, the schools, everything is being affected by this. And the bottom line is, we're not going to defeat China with tariffs. It's the equivalent of the wall. You know, it's not the right way to do it. You beat China by out-competing them, by dominating the new technologies, wind, solar, electric vehicles, artificial intelligence, additive manufacturing. We should be reinvesting back in the United States and beating them on the economic playing field. He does this because he knows he's going to get in the news cycle, and it's a way for him to look tough. I don't want you to look tough. I want you to be tough.
Well, on the other hand, the president is making this argument that the economy under his administration is strong, and the unemployment rate is at its lowest level in something like 50 years. How do you counter that argument, which is a powerful message for voters?
The economy is not strong. All you have to do is go to normal neighborhoods, normal communities, and you will see that the majority of Americans are still struggling. We've blown past the metrics of unemployment rate actually mattering for most people. I mean, people have two or three jobs. Yeah, the unemployment rate's low. Yeah, people, they're saying there's been a bump in the income. It's $20 a week. I mean, that people have loans. Healthcare is still a major issue. People are still losing their retirement. We've lost, you know, thousands of jobs in my community around General Motors. Ford just laid off thousands of people. I'm telling you, this is not working. This is the biggest myth going, is the president saying we've got a booming economy. Mm. We do not.
I'm speaking with Congressman Tim Ryan, a Democrat of Ohio who is running for president. And Congressman, is it time to start the process of impeaching President Trump?
Well, we need to continue to have the hearings and to publicly put Mueller in public in front of the Judiciary Committee. We need to bring everybody before Congress publicly on TV, and then see where we go from there. And if it leads to impeachment, then that's where we have to go. But I think it's important for us to educate the American people around this issue.
It sounds like you're in line with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi on the issue of impeachment. And people probably know you best for your effort to unsuccessfully challenge her for that job in 2016 and then again last year. Are you satisfied with the job that Nancy Pelosi is doing so far?
I am. I think she understands the strategy here. She is holding a caucus together, and I think she's doing a good job, and I think she's right on this. I want to continue to go down this road. We need to build public support for anything that's going to happen, and that's only going to happen by very public hearings until we get all of the facts out and the American people totally understand that this guy did obstruct justice. It's pretty clear.
You were so eager to get Nancy Pelosi out of that job. Why the change of heart? And now it sounds like you're totally fine with her being where she is.
Well, you know, my position is, I don't want to relitigate it. I've always had an enormous amount of respect for her, and I've always said that, even through challenging her. I do think that the Democrats have failed to have a real robust message for working class people in places like Ohio, these states that Donald Trump came in and won. That's my concern, is that people that I represent, white, black, brown, gay, straight, people who work for a living, take a shower after work, aren't really represented in today's politics. You know, the issue of competing with China and wages and everything else. We've got to talk to people about those issues, or they're not going to vote for us. And there is a chance that Donald Trump could win again. And so that was my concern, is that our party has become very, very coastal and very, very focused on issues that aren't resonating with working class people in the United States.
Finally, Congressman, you're running in a very crowded field of about 24 Democrats. You're polling at around 1 or 2%. Do you lose sleep at night wondering how in the world you are going to stand out in a crowd like that?
No, I don't. I've been to Iowa and New Hampshire. We're resonating. I was there for 3 days. We picked up a good number of volunteers and caucus goers who committed to us. We had good crowds everywhere that we went. And so we were excited about it. I come from the epicenter of deindustrialized America. I know what families are going through better than anybody, and I understand where we need to go in the new economy better than anybody. And I'm going to use the power of the CEO of America, the White House, to rebuild the economy in the United States and to take all these forgotten communities, forgotten people, and join them together to take this country back and get this government working.
Tell me something that most people don't know about you.
I have a chicken wing addiction.
How many do you eat at a time?
Well, you know, not a lot, but I eat them probably too often. Like I sometimes can't get out of a restaurant without at least trying their chicken wings. So that's my great downfall.
All right. Congressman Tim Ryan, a Democrat running for president. Thanks for your time. We appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
Memorial Day is coming. Summer is not far behind. In some parts of the country, it's time to see what happened under that grill cover over the winter. I am afraid. I'm sure there's something living in there. But what about the side dishes that don't get in the way of whatever main event you've got on the grill? Well, here now, resident chef Kathy Gunst has suggestions. Hi, Kathy.
Hi there.
And you have a new spin on old favorites. Look, I could eat New York deli heavy on the mayo every single day, but you say change it up.
Heavy on the mayo. You're talking about coleslaw.
Yeah.
Okay. I say change it up. I mean, how many years have you gone to the same barbecue or the same Memorial Day picnic and seen the glob of potato salad and that mayonnaise-y coleslaw?
It's just white.
It's all white food. And I say, why? The side dishes, I don't know. These are so good. You might forget about the burgers and the hot dogs and the fried chicken.
They look it.
I started with coleslaw and it got me to thinking of a huge question, philosophical even. Uh-huh. What makes American food American? I mean,
mayo.
Mayo. There isn't one answer.
It's French,
is pizza
though.
Italian or American? Is a hot dog German or American? And so this is my take on coleslaw. It's got all the texture and creaminess of a traditional slaw, but I introduced Indian flavors.
Oh my goodness. This is so good.
Isn't it fun? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like you take a bite and you think you're going to get coleslaw, and then your mouth says, wait, what?
And what is it?
It is sautéed shallots till they get a little crispy, mm-hmm. and you sauté them in coconut oil, which is worth finding. Mm-hmm. Then you add coconut flakes and green chili peppers. Mm-hmm. Then I mix the cabbage, red and white cabbage, with a lot of lime mm-hmm. and yogurt. And it is, I think, got some really good texture and flavor going.
And some crunch, which I'm sure people are listening to right now.
Are you crunching down on that? Yeah, you get the raw cabbage, which of course is so good for you. And then that zest of the lime and the bit of yogurt and some scallions. But it's really the green chilies and the shallots with the bit of coconut.
It's a meal,
yeah, right? Get
good.
Rid of your burgers.
Oh, boy. Okay, well, we want to hear everything else, although that this is going to be hard to top this. What's this with, you have asparagus here.
I do. So I also started thinking about a grilled salad for Memorial Day, but you don't want to just turn on the grill for that. So I took asparagus right now are in season in much of the country, and it's a short season, and they are so extraordinary when you find them just off a farm or at a mm-hmm. farmer's market. So I steamed them very lightly, and then I steamed some leeks, which are those big, fat, long, onion-like things. And then at the last minute, when you are grilling whatever you will be grilling this coming weekend, burgers or fish or chicken, you throw the asparagus and the leek on the grill so it gets a nice char.
Can I ask, throw it right on the grill or like in an aluminum?
No, right. I do it in a vegetable basket so the little pieces don't mm-hmm. fall through.
Right.
But the idea is that they're pre-cooked. So literally it's 2 or 3 minutes mm-hmm. on the grill while everything else is cooking. And then you serve it on some arugula with some crumbled up feta cheese and a very lemony chive vinaigrette.
I was just going to say, I can taste that lemon. It's very nice. It's very spring-like, end of spring,
Yeah, it's sort of like saying, okay, summer, we're ready. Mm-hmm. Come for us.
Which part of the leek? It's like a big fan.
All of it except for the dark, dark green part on top, which tends to be very tough.
Okay, we also have some deviled eggs here.
And this
is not my grandmother's deviled egg.
No, it's not. Okay. Well, it might be if your grandmother was into dilly beans.
Dilly beans are
pickled string beans. They are pickled in a vinegar solution. They also have fresh dill, and often they have chili pepper. And you can buy them at just about any supermarket, but we also have a link to my homemade version. And I thought deviled eggs, it's like the beginning of the season, and everybody brings deviled eggs, but Lord knows we need a new way to take a look at them.
You know, I always avoid the deviled eggs.
Why?
Maybe deviled egg avoidance. I think this is a big personality reveal.
I'm here to say
that if people see this deviled egg on their table this holiday, they should not avoid it. I think I avoid it because they're just a little bit like, what is that stuff on the top? You know, it just seems a little
like
foreign.
Yeah, paprika and parsley. Yeah. They're usually pretty bland. So I took parsley and scallions and chopped up dilly beans, a little bit of mayonnaise, a lot of fresh ground black pepper, and then I cut little pieces of dilly bean as a fun garnish that comes out of them. Again, can be made completely ahead of time so that you're not stressed on your
weekend. I've trolled quite a few aisles. I don't think I've ever seen a jar that says dilly beans.
I bet you've never looked.
It will, like in the pickled section?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. You can also use pickles if you can't find them. But making your own, you can do in 10, 15 minutes, throw them in the refrigerator, and they're ready the next day.
I know we're talking about sides, but a lot of people will be grilling meat. I was talking to a coworker about this segment earlier today, and he said, okay, but where's the meat? You know,
give
me just a quick tip for meat.
Okay, well, particularly after what Robin said, clean out the grill. Mm-hmm. And that means turn your grill on, whether it's charcoal or gas, get it really hot, and then use one of those metal brushes and scrub it. Just all the dust, all the old food, goodbye. You also want to just reacquaint yourself with direct heat, which is when you're cooking it right over the fire, or indirect. You can really play and get great results using a hot grill.
And for some of us, reacquaint yourself with your kitchen. That's Kathy Gunst. For more of her recipes, go to herenow.org. Kathy, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Have a great weekend.
And this is Here Now, a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now.